From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, John Irving talks about adapting his novel The Cider House Rules into a movie and why it took 13 years. Irving's novels The World According to Garp and The Hotel New Hampshire were also made into films, but he didn't write the screenplays. Also, we talk about pain and new techniques for treating it with Dr. Scott Fishman, author of The War on Pain and chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California, Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. It's not clear at this hour if, when, and where the grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez will meet with the six-year-old at the center of an international custody dispute. The grandmothers are currently at the Miami airport while go-betweens try to arrange a meeting with the boy, who's currently living with relatives. NPR's Eric Westervelt says the grandmothers want to meet with Elian at a neutral site away from Little Havana.
But the boy's Miami relatives say they want to meet right here at the great uncle's home in Little Havana where Elian has been living. They say they've prepared the house, they've prepared a meal, and that the grandmothers are welcome to come here. But we're at something of a stalemate where neither side of the family is willing to budge or compromise and either meet at a neutral site or meet at the house.
Eric Westervelt in Miami's Little Havana. In the meantime, members of Congress moved to grant the boy American citizenship. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Senate had only been back in session for an hour when Florida Republican Connie Mack declared that one of its first acts should be to make Elian Gonzalez a U.S. citizen. Mack says he has no doubt the grandmothers love the boy, but he also suspects an effort by Cuban leader Fidel Castro to manipulate American public opinion.
I have some pretty strong feelings about that I think that Elian ought to stay here in the United States. But I would stress that the legislation that I am proposing does not dictate an outcome. It says, in essence, that the decisions will be made by a court.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service ruled that the boy should be returned to his father in Cuba. But if Gonzalez were made a U.S. citizen, the matter would be out of the agency's hands. The soonest the Senate could act is Wednesday. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
Voters are getting their say tonight in the first official contest of the 2000 presidential election. The Iowa caucuses begin the season with the New Hampshire primary following 8 days later. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more from Des Moines.
Snow flurries are not what Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush are most worried about. The two presumed frontrunners fear that a lack of suspense, not the weather, will keep Iowans at home and away from their caucus sites. Both candidates have spent the last several days urging their supporters to get out the vote, despite headlines that suggest they have their respective contests wrapped up. Tonight, about a tenth of Iowa's registered voters are expected to go to more than 2,000 individual caucus sites. But those voters are informed more than two-thirds have met more than one candidate face-to-face this election season. Even the candidates are having a hard time staying away from each other here in Iowa. Gary Bauer went to church this morning for a little quiet time and ran smack dab into George W. Bush, prompting Bauer to surmise the Bush machine is everywhere. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News, Des Moines.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 243 points to close at 11,008 in heavy trading. This is NPR News from Washington. President Clinton called on Congress today to provide $27 million to ensure that women and men get equal pay for equal work. The government says women still earn only 75 cents for every dollar that men receive. The money would be used to educate employers and enforce equal pay laws, including the hiring of more inspectors. The stock market had its worst day in 3 weeks today, with all the major indexes down sharply. Prices fell amid a new wave of concerns about interest rates. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Stock prices started off the day higher, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average up as much as 100 points. But by the end of the afternoon, the gains had been wiped out and prices were down sharply. Fueling the decline were comments by the head of the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta, who said last year's three interest rate hikes had failed to ease inflation pressures. Many investors took that to mean the Fed would raise rates several times more, starting with its meeting next week. but there were also concerns that corporate profits won't be as high as previously thought. Johnson & Johnson and Cisco were among the big losers. It was the busiest trading day in NASDAQ history, with nearly 2 billion shares changing hands. Procter & Gamble was back up after saying its proposed merger with Warner Lambert was off the table. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Utility crews are struggling to restore power to more than 100,000 people in northern Georgia and northeast Alabama as more bad weather approaches. Power lines were downed by a weekend ice storm. Forecasters say the temperature is expected to drop into the teens and 20s in the region tonight. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When John Irving decided to adapt his novel The Cider House Rules into a movie, he never expected it would take 13 years. His new memoir, My Movie Business, is about those 13 years and what he learned about the differences between writing books and movies. He didn't write the screenplays for the earlier adaptations of his novels, The World According to Garp and The Hotel New Hampshire. The movie version of The Cider House Rules is set in the 1940s. It stars Michael Caine as Dr. Larch, who runs an orphanage where he also delivers the unwanted babies of women, babies who will remain at the orphanage. And he performs abortions. His apprentice and surrogate son, played by Tobey Maguire, is a young man who grew up in the orphanage and has learned how to deliver babies but won't perform abortions. Here's a scene with Caine and Maguire early in the film.
First pregnancy?
Yes, for both.
I presume you'd prefer handling the delivery?
All I said was, I don't want to perform abortions. I have no argument with you performing them.
You know how to help these women. How can you not feel obligated to help them when they can't get help anywhere else?
One, it's illegal. Two, I didn't ask how to do it, you just showed me.
What else could I have shown you, Homer? The only thing I can teach you is what I know. In any life, you have to be of use.
The Cider House Rules was inspired in part by John Irving's grandfather, Dr. Frederick C. Irving, an obstetrician who graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1910.
He was the chief of staff of the Boston Lying In, which was the country's foremost maternity hospital. He was a professor of obstetrics at Harvard. I know him better through his writing, through his several books on obstetrical and gynecological procedure, than I ever knew him as a kid. I can't recall, in fact, a single intimate conversation with him. He died Christmas Eve when I was 15. So it's through his writing that he made a principal and powerful influence on me for reasons that are still unclear to me. I was 14 at the time. I felt certain that I wanted to be a writer. It was about the time I started reading Charles Dickens, my earliest fictional hero. And I told my parents I wanted to be a writer when I grew up. And they said, oh, you should read your grandfather's books then. He's a writer. I'm not sure that obstetrical and gynecological procedure was entirely suitable for a 14-year-old.
Yeah, but, what was it like for you at the age of 14?
Riveting.
Were there illustrations of gynecological surgery and of childbirth and things like that?
No illustrations, except for the fact that he wrote very descriptive, if Victorian prose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I learned more about human reproduction from those books than I probably learned in school for, well, maybe ever.
Do you think that reading your grandfather's Victorian language and describing medical procedures affected the way you thought about the body or later wrote about the body?
That's a good question, but I've not thought of it before. I don't know so much that I was affected in that way as that the life of a doctor of medicine at that time and an obstetrician, gynecologist in particular, was one that I could imagine in full detail, so that in the early 1980s, when I began research for a novel about an orphanage physician and his relationship with an unadoptable orphan who's born in his orphanage and who is unsuccessfully, repeatedly unsuccessfully adopted. I had already in mind the kind of detail that I was looking for, the kind of detail that I would find. The surprise, of course, was the abortion subject, because I hadn't set out to write a novel or, in the case of the film of the Cider House Rules, a screenplay that was on or about the abortion subject. It was the relationship of that old physician and orphanage director and this unadoptable kid that I had foremost in mind. But when I began to read the histories of abortion and the histories of orphanage hospitals and the lives of orphanage physicians, that procedure and the life of an orphanage hospital was inseparable, of course, understandably, because if any physician, qualified physician, would take the risk in those days when that procedure was illegal, if any physician would take that risk and perform that procedure, who else but someone who had the sympathy for the condition of those women who came there and left children behind? And more importantly, or just as important, the fact that many of those orphans would not be adopted. The older they got, the less likely it was that anyone would take them, and they would eventually become what at the time was called wards of the state. That made a powerful impression on me, and I decided that the issue of performing that procedure or not performing it would become a crucial area of conflict between the young orphan whom the old physician apprentices, whom he trains to be a doctor, that would be a point of contention between them. Not that the orphan would ever disapprove of the old doctor performing abortions, nor would that orphan believe that women shouldn't have the right to have an abortion if they wanted one. It's just that he didn't want to perform the procedure himself. That is the argument of the story. It is by no means the current political so-called right to life or pro-choice argument. The novel and the film of the Cider House Rules is unequivocally pro-choice.
Now, you say that you were working on the screenplay over a 13-year period, and you worked with four different directors. The first director who you wanted to work with on the Cider House Rules passed away. Oh, what about the other two directors who were going to direct it before the final director, Lassie Hallström? Why didn't things work out?
Well, I think that I got to know Wayne Wang, the director that I first tried to work with after Philip Borsos' death. I got to know Wayne so little. We spent so little time together, and we seemed so immediately divided on where the story should go or what the principal story should be, that I can't really tell you why that relationship didn't work, except that it was clear from the beginning that I was listening more to the producer's notes on the script, Richard Gladstein's notes on the script, than I was to the would-be directors. And both Richard and I felt that if the writer is paying more attention to the producer than to the director, if the writer and the producer are seeing the story more eye to eye than the writer and the director, well, that wasn't just a good match. And Wayne had the grace and the intelligence to see that, I think, before I did. I mean, he very politely and said that he just didn't think this was going to work out, and he was right.
And the third director was?
Michael Winterbottom. I loved Michael's film of the Thomas Hardy novel, Jude. I thought that film was sensational, especially as a low-budget film, as it was. The performance he got out of Kate Winslet was amazing. The faithfulness to that novel was just indelible to me. I was very, very impressed. I was impressed that he could do period. I was impressed that he could do sort of sympathy for children. all the things that seem to me to be integral or essential to making the Cider House rules. I thought he'd be a good choice. But Michael felt that the romance between the young orphan, Homer, and the girlfriend of the young flyer who first brings the girl to the orphanage for an abortion and then goes off to the war, he felt that that romance was much more central to the story and more important to the story than Richard and I felt it ever should be. We felt that it was important to keep that love story a love affair, to keep it in perspective to the whole. It is one-third of the story of the Cider House Rules, but compared to the relationship between Dr. Larch and his beloved orphan, Homer, and the relationship between Mr. Rose, the black migrant apple picker, and his daughter, Rose Rose, and what that relationship precipitates in Homer, we felt that the love story between Homer and Candy was the small third of the three parts of the story. Winterbottom didn't agree.
My guest is novelist and screenwriter John Irving. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Irving. His new memoir, My Movie Business, is about adapting his novel The Cider House Rules into a movie. As you point out in your memoir, you created a compressed version of the story of The Cider House Rules for the screenplay. And you say the passage of time is so important in your novels, but that's not easily captured in a film. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in how time elapses in a novel as compared to on the screen?
I felt it was essential in taking a long novel and bringing it down to film size. And remember, this is a 2-hour and 5-minute film, short by today's standards. I see a lot of films today that I might have liked if they were half an hour shorter. I felt it was essential that we not indulge the length and the complexity of the material that's in the novel and give ourselves some justification to making a 3-hour movie. I don't like 3-hour movies. I didn't want to see a 3-hour movie. I wanted to see a movie that was even a little short by conventional standards. I think that just works better with an audience. And so the first decisions, the most radical decisions, were... what were you going to lose? Who are the characters and their attendant storylines that had to come out of the story whole? Because I feel strongly that if you can't honestly say that a character has the same emotional effect on an audience that that character had on readers, that character shouldn't be in the story to begin with. If you're only going to marginalize that character's emotional effect, lose the character. Those were essential choices and, well, painful ones, but the most radical decisions of what to cut out of the Cider House Rules were made before I'd collaborated with the first of these four directors. They were made when I wrote the first draft of the screenplay. I made them myself.
Is pruning your own novel to make a screenplay a little bit like performing surgery on yourself, you know, that you're too close to it?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a matter of how wholeheartedly or not you believe in the potential of the novel to be a film in the first place. In some cases, I look at my novels and I just don't see the potential film that's there. Or if I do, it seems too much of a compromise at the outset and I'm not interested in it. The thing about the Cider House Rules that made it instantly attractive to me as a potential film, almost from the moment the novel was finished, is that unlike all of my novels, or unlike most of the others of my novels, it was the sixth. I've written nine. I'm finishing a tenth. But it alone has the symmetry that only a journey away from home, which ends up back in the same place, can have. And symmetry is very gratifying in films. It's very gratifying. And it had, in other words, a structure that was instantly visual to me at the outset. I could see that orphan coming back to that orphanage. That was always the end of the story. And I could see it in film terms. I believed in its possibility as a film, which is why I wanted to be involved not only as a screenwriter, but to have approval of the director, to have approval of the cast, to ensure that the director had approval of Final Cut, all those things that writers aren't generally afforded, and which, in the case of other novels of mine made into films, I really haven't been concerned enough to ask.
I think often when a movie viewer, has read the book before seeing the movie, they really resent some of the changes that the movie's made. If a character's life is condensed, if the story is condensed, they feel, you know, that the movie has, like, cheated the novel. From your experience, I mean, you realize that there are changes that have to be made in order to accommodate the larger story of the novel into the short amount of time that's covered by, you know, the short amount of time in the movie theater. You write a little bit about Dr. Larch, the doctor at the orphanage, and how you had to kind of pare down some of the characteristics that you'd given him for the book. How did you decide how to change his character, you know, how to alter it for the movie?
I didn't change his character or alter it for the movie. Your first way of putting it is the best. I did tone him down. Lasse additionally toned him down. And brilliantly, I thought, Michael Caine, who played Dr. Larch, also toned the doctor down. In the case of Larch, his dialogue, what he says, is of such a polemical and didactic nature. He is such a moral tyrant in the life of this young orphan. He's right, of course, but he's a tyrant nonetheless. We thought it was essential that we not deviate in the film from what he says in the book. And the truth is that every line of dialogue or voiceover Larch speaks in the film is from some text in the novel. The difference is that the Larch of the novel is a shouter. He's a browbeater. He's a moral bully. And Michael played him much softer, as if he were much more tired out. Your sense of the doctor's ether addiction and its ongoing effect on him, I think, is greater in the film even than it was in the novel. And that's what I would call a soft choice. And I think it was a wise one. I'm happy to see the screenplay being praised as much as it is, but I think that many of Lasse's choices as a director and many of Michael's choices as an actor have made me look better.
Did adapting your novel, The Cider House Rules, into a screenplay lead you to reconsider any of your opinions of your movies that were adapted by other screenwriters?
No, I like those films. I like George Roy Hill's The World According to Garp. I like Tony Richardson's The Hotel New Hampshire. I just felt detached from them. I liked Mark Steven Johnson's Simon Birch, as it was called. I simply didn't think it was close enough to the novel to be called A Prayer for Owen Meany or to use the names of my characters. And Mark and I were in agreement about that from the moment I read his screenplay. I just felt it was too divergent from my novel to use my novel's titles or the names of my characters. Contrary to everything I've read, wherein I'm described as alternately despising the film or whatever, I liked Simon Birch. I just didn't think it should be called A Prayer for Owen Meany, and it wasn't.
In the 13 years that it took to actually get The Cider House Rules to the screen, did you lose interest? Did you ever feel, I'm just really sick of this?
No, you don't lose interest in an experiment as long as you don't change your mind. The experiment was, I've seen films of my novels made other ways, namely by letting them go. Let's see, if I don't let one go, how long it takes and if it'll ever get made. I was prepared at the outset that the film would never be made. I knew that if it were ever made, it would be made with my approval. And so that was the game. If someone had told me at the beginning it was going to take 14 years, I might not have been so eager to play the game. But once you start, I don't think you can back out. I mean, you've got to be faithful to something and follow through on it. And however long it takes, I intend to do the same thing with The Son of the Circus.
When you're on a plane or a train and you see a passenger reading one of your books, do you introduce yourself?
No. No, I kind of hope I won't be recognized. I wouldn't want to interrupt them from reading the book. They're much better served to be reading the book than they are to be having a conversation with me.
Say they're just carrying the book, and they're not reading it at the moment you see them. Wouldn't say anything?
Well, that would make me cross, yes. I would think, what are you doing instead of reading this book? I had the misfortune once of seeing a woman on a plane back from Los Angeles, actually. I was traveling with my eldest son, and a woman across the aisle, diagonally across the aisle, was reading The World According to Garp, and at some point she closed the book and stuffed it into the air sickness bag in the little envelope in the seat in front of her and never took it out again. And my son was dying to draw her attention to the fact that the man who had offended her so was sitting right across the aisle. So we had a very tense trip all the way to New York, but I was never identified as the culprit who had written the offending passage. Whichever one it is that made her close the book, I'll never know. But it was a highlight. I'll never forget it.
Well, John Irving, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Irving's new memoir, My Movie Business, is about adapting his novel, The Cider House Rules, into a movie. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from virtualrelocation.com, an online resource for moving and relocation, featuring cost of living comparisons and virtual city tours at virtualrelocation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, diagnosing and treating pain. We talk with Dr. Scott Fishman about new pain medications and how they work. Fishman is the author of the new book, The War on Pain. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pain is often more than just the physical hurt. It can create fear and emotional suffering. My guest, Dr. Scott Fishman, is the author of a new book about the latest techniques for treating pain. It's called The War on Pain. Dr. Fishman is the chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California, Davis. He's the former director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Pain Center. I asked him, what is pain?
Well, that question goes to the very heart of why we have pain specialists, because pain is almost impossible to define. We've been trying to define it for thousands of years, and those of us who specialize in treating pain have come to the understanding that pain is ultimately what the patient says it is. That's the guiding definition that most of us follow.
What does that mean, and how is that useful?
Well, it means that when somebody comes to me or goes to another physician or complains of pain in general, we believe them, and I always assume that someone is suffering from something. The problem with pain is that it's intrinsically subjective. And when one person says they have pain, they may have a completely different experience than another person who says they have pain, even though they may say their pain is just as severe. So when someone complains of pain, it may mean that they are feeling a sharp stabbing sensation, whereas another person might mean that they're missing a loved one.
What function does physical pain serve?
Physical pain has an important function, and life is not of very high quality if we don't have a pain system, because the pain system serves as our alarm. It's our sensor to the outside world that tells us that we have impending danger or have been harmed. And it gives us an advantage of being able to potentially react and preclude any further damage or avoid damage from happening to us. So if we are getting close to a stove, we may feel a burning sensation, we may pull back, and that's why we all have that kind of reflex. If we didn't have our pain sensors or pain nerves, and there are actually people who are born genetically without pain sensors, they tend to have really serious injuries because they're not able to modulate the world around them, and they get burned, they get injured, they wind up actually losing limbs sometimes. Life is not a comfortable place without a pain alarm. The problem is when that alarm gets over-triggered and then loses its purpose.
Chronic pain.
Either chronic pain or pain that has even in fact, the pain of childbirth. Now, some people might argue that that does have a purpose, but for someone who is in the midst of severe suffering, I would argue that the pain of childbirth has really potentially lost its evolutionary role in that in primitive times, the pain of childbirth would force you to stop what you're doing and take heed to the event that's occurring. In modern times, we're already taking heed and we're controlling the situation. So further suffering may be interpreted as unnecessary. And I think there are many women in the world who would testify that turning that alarm off at that time is a real blessing.
Now, a lot of common pain is caused by inflammation. Why do pain and inflammation go hand in hand?
Well, because inflammation, pain occurs at the time of injury or impending injury. And when injury occurs, the healing process is enlisted. And that healing, the first step of that healing process is inflammation. Inflammation is really the biological phenomena of rushing in all the different kinds of cells that we need to not only start healing, but continue to protect an area. So, for example, if one were to bump their elbow, the elbow might swell if it was a severe enough bump. And that swelling would serve to do a bunch of different things. One would be to start the healing process in case blood vessels were broken or tissues were damaged. And it would do so by bringing in white cells that would fight off bacteria and other what we call inflammatory mediators. The secondary function is going to be to sensitize the tissues so that that elbow might remain sore. And the purpose of the elbow remaining sore is that the threshold for it to illicit pain is decreased. And anybody knows this intuitively, that when we have an injury, we tend to protect it. And that protection is the purpose of the link between inflammation and pain.
There's some inflammation that isn't helpful at all, like arthritis.
With arthritis, you have an underlying process of joints being constantly injured by the disease of arthritis. Typically, in osteoarthritis, it's an inflammatory process, and that process is stimulating the normal system to ring out its alarm because damage is occurring. And so we try to treat arthritis by two different mechanisms. One is to reduce the inflammation and treat the pain by that mechanism. But now a very promising way to treat the pain is to treat the underlying disease and slow down that process of inflammation. So there are now new medications that really go at the heart of arthritis and are slowing down the actual effects on the joints before the pain occurs.
What drugs are those?
Well, there are numerous drugs, and I won't go into detail on them with their names, but there are different drugs that decrease the cell turnover that occur in the joints themselves.
Mm-hmm. There's a new class of anti-inflammatories that operate differently than, say, aspirin or ibuprofen. And we've seen advertisements for a lot of these all the time on TV. Celebrex and Vioxx are two of these new anti-inflammatories. What are they, and how are they different from drugs like Tylenol and Advil and Motrin?
Well, I'll start off answering that by talking about the more standard drugs like ibuprofen, aspirin, and Tylenol. These are drugs that have been exquisitely successfully used for managing all sorts of pain by consumers around the world, and all you need to do is walk through the analgesic section of any drugstore to see how many choices there are in these this different class of drugs. They're thought to be very safe, and they're safe enough to be over the counter. However, even these drugs, when used in too high doses or for too long a period of time, can have serious side effects, and even side effects that can be life-threatening. The big side effects for drugs like aspirin or ibuprofen is that they cause ulcers and they cause bleeding problems. And that is what has been addressed with this new class of drug, which is very much like a ibuprofen-type drug or an Advil-type drug without the propensity to cause ulcers or bleeding problems.
So how do they function in your body? Maybe you could give us a layman's explanation.
Sure.
Of how they manage to reduce the swelling without causing the ulcers.
Well, the COX-2 refers to the cyclooxygenase type 2 enzyme. Enzymes are mediators of reactions in the body. And what these drugs do is they block the enzyme. The enzymes required for the process of inflammation as well as generation of pain. So when we block the enzyme, we can help block pain. The problem is that the enzyme does other things other than causing pain. And in the stomach and on the platelets within the blood, the enzyme has a vital role of protecting the stomach and in maintaining our ability to clot our blood. So when we go to block the enzyme either in the spinal cord or in the elbow or wherever we're feeling our pain, we simultaneously block it in the stomach and in the blood when we use medicines like ibuprofen. The safety factor for the COX-2 inhibitors, and what's really brilliant about these drugs, is that the developers were able to find out that the enzyme in the stomach and in the blood is slightly different than the one that may modulate, may be involved with inflammation and with pain. So they've been able to select out just that enzyme so that the new drugs only block the enzymes that we think are involved with pain and don't block the enzymes in the stomach or the blood, thus allowing for normal stomach function and normal bleeding function. The problem with them is that the enzyme that's involved with pain and inflammation is also an enzyme that is in the kidney. So it's something that we watch chronically. Any of these drugs, including ibuprofen, aspirin, or the new COX-2 products like Vioxx or Celebrex, can cause some problems with the kidneys long term. So it's something that we watch closely.
These new anti-inflammatories are very new. How much do we know about the long-term effects? How much do we know about what the side effects are if you're using it for chronic pain?
Well, it's a good question. With any of these new drugs, we really don't have a long historical view of what they do, but they do appear to be safe, and they've undergone very, very rigorous testing initially in animals and then in humans. FDA really puts them through their paces to make sure that they're safe. So they look pretty safe, but as your question implies, you never know until they're time tested.
And what are they mostly being prescribed for?
Well, they're being prescribed for a lot of different things, primarily for arthritis kind of pain, but we're now using them for all kinds of chronic pains across the board, from pain that's related to different tissue damages to pain that's related to nerve damage. We're using them in any patient that really has a high risk of either ulcer formation or particularly bleeding problems.
My guest is pain specialist Dr. Scott Fishman, author of the new book, The War on Pain. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dr. Scott Fishman. He's chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California at Davis, and he's the author of the new book, The War on Pain. Why is chronic pain often so difficult to treat?
Well, the problem with chronic pain, as I said before, it's pain that has lost its real purpose. It's the alarm system gone awry, and it's pain that has lasted beyond a reasonable period of healing. The problem with that is that it doesn't make sense, and it's not serving a purpose. So it's essentially a problem in the body that's become intractable. And as we said before about the definition of pain being so difficult to define for every individual, over time, pain has different meanings for different people. You can't have pain without a mind, so it's always a mind-body phenomenon. And because of that, it becomes very individualized. It's hard to have cookie-cutter solutions, and it requires really looking at people's bodies and their minds and their lives.
Well, we'll get to the mind and pain some more in a bit. You describe lower back pain as being particularly problematic, and for anybody who's had lower back pain, they know that's true. Why is lower back pain very difficult to treat?
Well, you know, if you look at the statistics on low back pain, it's hard to treat, but for most of us, it comes and goes and isn't a big problem in our lives. For others of us, low back pain can become intractable and can really limit our ability to get on with our lives, if not enjoy our lives. It's difficult to treat back pain because we've not understood it in its entirety. And we probably don't understand it completely now, but we understand it better than ever. In fact, now when someone has an acute flare-up of low back pain, we no longer send them directly to bed. We know that it's best for them to do the activities that they can do that don't cause pain without ceasing their function. And we also make sure that they don't overdo it as well, because they can further injure their back. So we don't throw people also into aggressive physical therapy anymore. So we're coming to understand the balance of how the body heals once the back has become inflamed or otherwise irritated. The back has a multitude of different reasons to cause pain, which really reflects the incredible organ that the spine is. The spine does an amazing job in terms of being able to make our bodies flexible and move with ease, despite carrying an enormous amount of weight on it and force. So as we get older, the back starts to wear, and as it wears, the pain signals, the pain fibers are triggered. And for most of us, we're able to manage that. But for some of us, that wear and tear causes pain that just doesn't stop. And for those kinds of patients, we take what we call a regional approach, where we look at the spine and look at the areas that can cause the pain. And kind of like a Columbo-type medical detective, we step-by-step look for the common suspects, rule out those who aren't involved, and go after the nerves that might be involved and help target treatments that go right to the point of pain. These are treatments like epidural injections or nerve root injections or other kinds of joint injections in the back that either use steroids to block inflammation and pain or local anesthetics to turn off the nerves that may be inflamed. There's something about turning the signal off that allows the body to heal, and we really try to rely on that as much as we can.
Now, I know for some people who have back pain, they have these little, like little vibrators put on their back, and it kind of like goes back and forth on your back, just kind of like tapping it a lot, is my understanding. And is the goal of that to distract you from the other pain?
Well, this is something called TENS. It's a TENS unit, and essentially delivers a little bit of an electrical shock to the skin.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, we don't know exactly how it works, and it doesn't work for everybody, but for some, they feel that it makes an enormous amount of difference. And what it does is it provides a bit of sensation to the nervous system that is not necessarily noxious or painful. But that signal, when it reaches the spinal cord, can crowd out the pain signal that's coming in. And this is probably no different than what we're doing with products like Icy Hot or Bengay, something what I would call a counter irritant, which substitutes a sensation that is bearable for one that isn't bearable. It's based on the idea that the central nervous system or the spine can only take so much sensation in at once. And if you crowd it with sensations that are bearable, the ones that aren't won't get through. This is probably also the reason why if you bang your shoulder, even before you know your shoulder's banged, your arm may go to it and you may be rubbing your skin. Or when you cut yourself, you may want to touch the skin, and that makes it feel better. This is a very interesting area for us because there's a new technology that we're using that takes us one step further, or one step really inward. It's a technology called spinal cord stimulation, where we take a very fine filament and place it just like an epidural catheter, really the same way that we'd place an epidural catheter for temporary pain relief for a pregnant woman, into the spinal cord area, in an area called the epidural space, and we deliver a tiny little charge just like the one that we would use on the skin, but this is directly at the level of the spinal cord. It's barely perceptible for the patient, but it's enough to crowd out the pain. And this has become a very, very successful technique for treating chronic low back pain or chronic pains in other areas of the body for certain conditions.
My guest is Dr. Scott Fishman, and he's written a new book called The War on Pain. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dr. Scott Fishman. He's chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California at Davis and the author of the new book, The War on Pain. You say in your book that some patients say, don't try to dismiss my pain by saying the pain is in my mind. I really feel this. Well, you point out the pain is in your mind, that it's the mind that processes the reaction that we describe as pain. Therefore, are you more optimistic about ways of using mind-body therapy to deal with pain?
Well, I would say my patient's worst fear, and probably their worst fear when they see any of their doctors, is that their doctor is going to tell them that their pain is all in their mind. And the problem with that is the misconception that if we consider the mind, we're implying to the patient that they're somehow a crock or we don't believe them. Whereas I would argue just the opposite, that as you mentioned, you can't have pain without a mind. If we're going to treat the most difficult problems with chronic pain, we're not going to be successful unless we consider the full entity of the pain, and that always includes the mind. I'm not suggesting that everyone with pain needs psychotherapy or psychological intervention. In fact, many patients do not, and I'm able to very successfully treat pain with just physical modalities. But when pain exceeds those kinds of treatments, I think it always requires looking at it in what I would call a holistic manner, in terms of that interface between the mind and body, to look at all of the factors that may be impacting pain.
Have you worked with treatments like acupuncture, hypnosis, biofeedback, relaxation techniques to deal with pain?
We have, and I have, and we continue to in our program and many other wonderful programs throughout the country. The issue with the mind and body is that each of us, I think, knows from watching television and other experiences that people have done incredible things with their mind in terms of blocking pain. We've all seen athletes who have played the end of a championship game with a broken leg, mothers who have lifted cars off of children, and people who have done superhuman Ironman triathlons by psyching themselves out. And what that implies is that intrinsically we have enormous pain-relieving properties that we can harness. And that's what our therapies try to do. The opposite is also true, that our intrinsic properties can also magnify pain and make pain worse, particularly when pain has become chronic and is around for a long time. It's kind of like the stereo being turned up louder and louder. And what we try to do is turn that volume down using our own intrinsic healing processes that have been exceptionally well harnessed through modalities like hypnosis and biofeedback, guided imagery, meditation. We really don't know how therapies like acupuncture work, but acupuncture appears to be exceptionally safe. So when the therapy appears to be effective and is safe, while I would like to know how it works, that's not a requirement for using it. So we also use therapies like acupuncture for these cases.
Are there any of these alternative therapies that you have found to be particularly effective in pain, or do you think it really depends on who the person is and what the pain is?
Well, it depends on the person, and I think to be able to harness one's internal pain-relieving properties, you have to want to, and not everybody wants to. One of the problems is that patients often fear that if they do allow these psychological techniques to help them feel better, it will imply that they were a crock, or it will mean on some level that their pain wasn't real. So they may be hesitant on some level to engage in them. I think anybody who's willing to can benefit from these therapies, because there's no question that we have a lot of control over how much we sense.
What is the new thing on the horizon that you're most looking forward to now in pain relief?
Well, there are too many new things to just pick out one, but there are many new receptor systems that have been discovered that are going to now help us much more specifically to target pain treatments to exactly the nerves that we need the medicines to go to. There are better treatments that will have less side effects. There are treatments that will help us not use drugs, but to use other things like these spinal cord stimulators. There are drug delivery systems that are going to allow us to give medications without using needles or injections. There are exciting therapies like inhaled morphine-type therapies, modalities that drive medicines right through the skin with an electrical charge so that one doesn't even have to take pills. All sorts of exciting therapies. And then there's very, very exciting work going on in terms of understanding how to undo the knot of chronic pain on patients' quality of life in terms of psychological approaches. And this will really bear greatly on treatment successes in the future.
Dr. Scott Fishman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott Fishman is the author of The War on Pain and chief of the Division of Pain Medicine at the University of California, Davis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from a new CD by composer and soprano saxophonist Philip Johnston, who is, among other things, the co-founder of the Microscopic Septet, which performs our theme. This is the title track from his new CD, The Merry Frolics of Satan. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Working with Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. And from Saab, proud sponsor of Jazz at Lincoln Center and its Essentially Ellington High School Jazz Band Competition and Festival. Information at saabjazz.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, John Lennon's secret FBI files and historian John Wiener's 14-year battle to gain access to them through the Freedom of Information Act. Wiener's new book about Lennon's FBI files is called Gimme Some Truth. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.